What is going on, comic fam? It's your boy, the Bearded Comic Bro, and I am joined by writer, comic creator, Fabian Nicieza. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
I am so excited. I want to jump into talking about your books, Suburban Dicks and The Self-Made Widow. Both are fantastic. But before we do that, I got to ask a little bit about your comic book journey that led you into being a writer full-time and things like that. So did you always like comic books, or was this as a kid, or did they come later on in life?
Yeah, no, totally. From a super early age, I remember before we came to the United States from Argentina, probably between the ages of 3 and 4, my brother, who's 3 years older, would get a magazine in Argentina called Antiojito y Antifaz. And it was two cartoony-like characters, friends, who got into all kinds of mischiefs and stuff. I couldn't read, obviously, but I distinctly remember the pictures and their images. You can look them up. They still exist to this day, actually. So we're talking about like 1965, 66.
Oh, nice.
And when we came to this country, one of the first things my brother and I kind of recognized was Batman and Superman, because they were airing the 50s TV show for Superman and the 1940s Batman serial in black and white from the movies in the 40s were both Oh, wow. Running on television in Argentina. My brother would watch them. I would watch them. I was 3 years old, 4 years
right.
old. And because he recognized Superman and Batman, he asked my parents if we can get a comic. They were only 12 cents, and we certainly didn't have a lot of money when we first came here, so they were okay with it. That just kind of got us hooked. We just kept getting them because it was it wasn't an expensive thing to ask okay. for my parents. And about 1 year into being in the country, maybe a little bit less, so we're looking at sometime in 1967, a friend at my brother's school said to him, "You don't want to be reading those comics. You want to be reading these cool comics." And those were Marvel comics. So my brother, wanting to fit in and wanting to belong, said, "We have to get these other ones." And I was like, "Oh, okay." I was 5 years old. And we got Spider-Man and we got Fantastic Four. So we're looking at 1967. So Stan and Jack on FF and Stan and John Romita on Spider-Man. And never stopped, really. Never stopped ever after that.
That's a good place to jump into it.
Yeah, I bought comics every single month, not every week, but every single month for the rest of my life until I got a job at Marvel in 1985. Then I got most of them for free. So,
that's a heck of a deal. So where was the point then, growing up reading comics where you're like, I want to start creating comics, writing comics, and eventually working.
Very early on, because my brother and I both drew. He drew, so I tried to draw and I followed him. We both drew a lot. My father encouraged it. My father was a weird cat. He was an engineer, and he mostly worked for toy companies, but he worked for a lot of different companies. And he mostly did line operations, methods, and standards on assembly lines, Okay. So he did a lot of toy work. He worked for Remco and Mattel and Kenner and Hasbro, and he also painted and sculpted clay. He did wonderful sculptures in clay, and he encouraged the art in me and my brother, even though he was not in any way, shape, or form a comic book fan or a superhero fan. He could care less about any of that stuff, but he never discouraged us from drawing. Which was to our benefit, because a lot of parents do. So we just drew all the time, and it was a very natural inclination to go from copying the images you see in a comic and trying to make a drawing like that to starting to draw your own images to trying to tell a story. I never felt satisfied enough just doing a single piece illustration. So I always wanted to move the characters through the drawings I was doing. And that in and of itself is the beginnings of storytelling, So I was writing my own comics and stories probably by the age of between 10 and 12, and really, really, really gravitated more toward the writing, because I found I was a good artist, but never a good enough artist. I was voted, most artistic in high school, but I wasn't good enough to draw professionally. I ended up being good enough to be able to show a professional artist what I was looking for, and then they were able to turn it into gold. So I started writing more and more. Even though I was still drawing every single day, I started writing more. And by the time I was already in high school, very early in high school, I knew that I would like to be a writer, but I also realized very, very early on that it's not the kind of thing that you get hired to do when you're young. You know, I read like crazy, and I never once saw a picture of a single author on the back of a book who looked like they were 20 years old. You know, back when I was like 13, 14, they all looked really old. They were at least 35, you know.
That's so old.
So I realized very early on, which a lot of people don't get. And that surprised me when I became a professional, how many people are just don't quite seem to understand how the world works. I just realized if I want to become a writer, my best bet is to try to get work in a field that gives me an opportunity to write. Yeah. So I tried to get a job in advertising out of college. I also interviewed at Marvel in DC out of college. I ended up getting a job at Berkeley Publishing, which is a paperback book publisher. And their sister hardcover company was Putnam. This was way, way back before the days where Penguin Random House bought every single company under existence. So I worked for Berkeley Putnam for 2 years. And right as I was ready to start trying some chapter samples to show the editors there for their series books that churned through a lot of authors under a pseudonym. So they had like Nick Carter, which was a spy series, and Gunsmith, which was a Western series, stuff like that. They had to publish one a month. So they churned through a lot of authors because they didn't pay well. It was published under a pseudonym, but it's a really good way to just develop your chops, right? And more importantly for me, although I had a job on the inside, showing the editors there that I can write, showing them that I know how to write. So then hopefully you do enough of those, you get a chance to show them your quote unquote real work, you know? Right as I was ready to start those chapter samples, because I'd been at Berkeley for almost 2 full years by that point. As often happens in publishing, a friend of a friend has a sister working at Marvel, and she's looking to hire an assistant. And I interviewed for that job, even though it wasn't necessarily a job or a department I wanted. It was at Marvel Comics, which I did want still. And they offered me the job, and I took it. As much because it was more money than I was getting paid, but ultimately it's because I knew that if I ever wanted to write comics, I had to get my foot in the door at Marvel. It was really going to be that much more challenging to try to do it from the outside in rather than the inside out. Because back then they still hired internal staff people to write comics. They don't do that anymore now, but they used to back then.
Okay,
so once you got working for Marvel in August of 1985.
Oh, wow. And so once you got kind of in the door working for the editor, you were able then to start to show some examples of your writing.
I actually the job I got hired for at Marvel, I only did for about 4 months because the guy who got hired instead of me in 1983 was hiring an assistant in the promotions department. And that's where I wanted to be. I wanted to be in the advertising promotions department because that's what I went to school for. And I also thought that would be a better opportunity for me to have an impact on the company. The department I was hired for was a manufacturing assistant in the Marvel Books division. And Marvel Books back then was not trade paperbacks and hardcovers. Marvel Books back then was a Fisher Price licensing deal that did sticker books and coloring books and stuff like that. Oh, wow. The only contact I had with editorial in that job in 4 months was with Bob Budiansky, who was the special projects manager at Marvel. And he was responsible for these quarterly press posters we used to do, gorgeous 22x34 full color posters. Some of them were the better covers that we published, like Mike Zeck's Punisher number one cover. Others were original illustrations, like this Kevin Nowlan Doctor Strange painting that he did. If you saw them, you go, oh yeah, I recognize that instantly. And so we did a quarterly series of four press posters for sale at in the direct market. And my job as manufacturing assistant was to handle that, because the printers who handled the posters were not the same as the printers who handled the comics. It's different paper, different printing press, all this other stuff. So I realized I want to do advertising and promotion because I think that that's better for me, and B, I want to have a better access to the actual comic books rather than what I'm doing. So I basically stabbed the poor woman in the back who hired me and switched over to promotions. And within a year, we'd gotten a boss hired above us who was going to create an entire little department. So he named me advertising manager. So for 5 years, I was Marvel's advertising manager. Any house ad you saw in the comics back then, any subscription ad, any promotional poster you saw in the direct market, on any kind of giveaway, promotional giveaway, that was all my responsibility. That was my job. I did all of that. An Avengers ID card that came with a blank spot for your photo, combined with a little thing on the back promoting Hawkeye and Solo Avengers, that was me. A house said inside the comic, that was me. So it was a great job because I got to interact with pretty much every single department in the company, because we interacted with licensing and international publishing and comic books, and I really enjoyed that job a lot. It also exposed me to the editors, all the editors, so they got to know me. And back then, there was a real division between sales, promotion, and editorial. And that slowly really started to kind of fall away. The new hires in promotion, in direct sales and promotion and publicity, combined with a change in philosophy and editorial, really kind of helped things come together a little bit better. So it was a really good time back then. Post shooter, it was a really, really fun, enjoyable, interactive workplace where people from different departments talked and got along a lot better than they had been.
Nice.
And that's so when I sold my first work, my first comic. I actually sold my first script to Jim Owsley, who is the writer Christopher Priest. Jim was the editor of the Spider-Man books back then.
Oh, wow.
And I sold him an inventory story. Inventory stories were completed issues, the whole thing done in a drawer. The art was penciled, lettered, and inked, and they had color guides already. And the whole reason for that is because you couldn't screw up the schedule. You couldn't miss your newsstand shipping. Wow. Slot. Now everything ships late, nobody cares, but back then as much as half the market for many of our books was the newsstand, and if you missed your shipping on your newsstand, you lost that rack space, you didn't get it back. So basically that would be hundreds of thousands of copies that are down the tube because they're not going out, so every editor knew that they couldn't miss shipping, so they always had an inventory story in the drawer. That was a rule Jim Shooter had, and it was a great opportunity for younger writers to try to sell stories, because the main monthly writers rarely ever wrote their own inventory stories, so I sold an inventory story, a Spider-Man inventory story, to Jim, and he never sent it out to get penciled, and he got fired before that it ever got sent out to get penciled. And the new editor was Jim Salicrup, and Jim didn't want to do the story because he didn't like the plot. I was like, so my first comic published could have been a Spider-Man issue. Probably it would have been Web of Spider-Man or Peter Parker. The inventory story probably wouldn't have run in Amazing Spider-Man. So that was actually I kind of took it pretty gracefully because I understood what was happening. I understood the ebb and flow of stuff. And then one day I'm walking in the hallway and Bob Budiansky comes out of his office. I got a bunch of things. I'm going to 5-6 different editorial offices. And he goes, you wanted to write, don't you? And I go, yeah, I'd like to. And I'm going to try. I almost had a story with Jim. And he goes, you want to pitch some Cyforce inventory stories? And I said, New Universe had just started. Only 3 issues had come out so far, and they were already so far behind on the schedule that Bob is desperately asking the advertising manager in the hallway if he wants to write a story for him. And I said, he goes, you know the book? I go, yeah, of course I do. He goes, will you pitch me some ideas? I go, sure. So I went home that night. I read the first 3 issues of the book because I hadn't yet. And the next day I gave him like 10 story ideas. And I gave them to him in very concise paragraph format. Jim Shooter was still the editor in chief back then. So I tailored it. I tailored it in a way that it presented the story with the hook that Shooter always was looking for, which is called the can't must conflict.
Okay.
I can't go stop Doc Ock from robbing that bank because I must bring these drugs to Aunt May, who's dying of her 50th heart attack. But I must stop Doc Ock from robbing that bank because it's wrong. Yet I can't because Aunt May is dying of her 57th heart attack, you know? So yeah. Shooter always wanted a can't must conflict, which is really an excellent and important thing from a storytelling standpoint. Sometimes we'd have to shoehorn them or force them in. But either way, on each paragraph for the pitch of the story, I gave the can't must conflict, knowing that that would help Bob Budiansky, the editor, because he knew that the pitch already had a bit of Shooter proof aspect to it. So like Bob read them, and over the weekend it was, I don't even remember exactly, but the next day he came up to me with the paper in his hand with all my pitches, and he said, I'd like to do this one first. And when he said first, my brain just like, I went beyond thinking I just sold a story to Bob, I have a chance to sell a story to Bob, to there was enough there that he liked and he wants me to do more. And that was great. So that just got the ball rolling. I just kept writing. I just kept writing after that. Different editors, different inventory stories. Shooter named me the monthly writer of Cyforce just within a few months, faster than I should have, but there was a whole lot of shaking up going on. So I wrote Cyforce until it was canceled. So I got 16 issues of Cyforce under my belt, which was good because it was a great experience to get to write a monthly book on a monthly schedule. And then I just kept writing anything I could until I got New Warriors. When I got New Warriors, that really changed the ball game for me quite a bit in the office and outside of the office as well.
And that's a great series. So that's like, I think it was issue 20. Is that where, Marvel Boy, fights?
Where Marvel Boy lashes out at his father.
Yeah, like, holy cow.
Abusive to him and accidentally kills his father.
Yeah. Holy cow. Like, that was some like powerful writing. So like that was one of your, you know, Cyforce and then that.
Yeah. It wasn't just from one to the next. I was like, I called 1988 or 89 my year of scut work. I was doing all these backup stories of annual backups and inventory issues. And we were starting a weekly book called Marvel Comics Presents. So the editor had almost like a full year in advance of the release of the book, because you had to compile a lot of content to be able to meet a weekly schedule. So a lot of us were going nuts selling 8-page stories to Terry Cavanaugh, the editor of Marvel Comics Presents. So I must have written 10 8-page stories for 10 different characters for Terry. Some of them didn't get published until 3, 4, 5 years into the book's run. There's a Red Wolf story that appeared in issue 73 of Marvel Comics Presents, which was the first issue that Barry Windsor-Smith's Weapon X series debuted. I did a Red Wolf story with Javier Saltarez there. Javier did it and I did it with him before he got Ghost Rider, before a lot of this stuff. It took that long to get to that issue. And 73 issues was only, when you think about it, a little over a year's worth of Marvel Comics Presents publishing, you know.
Wow.
So, but it was a good opportunity for a lot of us to do that kind of work, because it also really honed your skills quite a bit. Telling a story with a beginning, middle, and end in a self-contained nature in 8 pages is a really good way to teach you how to really tighten your message, how to really understand how to introduce a story, complicate a story, and resolve a story in simpler increments. And if you understand it in simpler increments, then it makes it actually easier in a lot of ways to stretch it out for a 22-page comic, you know? So that whole time, I wouldn't take any of that time back. It was really just great learning, great opportunity. I got to work with a tremendous amount of artists who I may not have gotten to work with otherwise, like Don Heck and Dave Cockrum. So all of that, and Steve Ditko on Speedball stories. So it was fun because I got to work with, you know, a lot of the people I grew up reading, and that was cool too.
Yeah. And so then in your time, then, like you said, you were in New Warriors and you were working on X-Men, you know, eventually, you know, then leading to Deadpool and things like that. Like, you kind of just had your hand in a little bit of everything at Marvel, like, it seems like.
Well, there was between my responsibilities in the office and my influence in terms of friendship and connections within the office, I had a lot of input and for lack of a better word, I don't want to say status, because that's elevates my titled position to vice president, which it wasn't. You know, I was an advertising manager, then I was an editor, but I was also incredibly loud and obnoxious, so that automatically got me very noticed. Because I knew so many people within the company from my job, having touched base with so many different departments, I understood what everybody had to do. So I brought a perspective to each of their jobs that they may not have had, because they only had to do what they had to do. Being an editor in a comic book company is actually often a very isolated existence. You have a set amount of titles you have to get out every month, and that's a hard thing to do in and of itself. You don't have time to worry about what licensing needs or is doing. You don't have time to think about international publishing and what they need and what they're doing. Luckily for me, my advertising manager job got me to see all of that, you know? And then when I became an editor, I took over a lot of Marvel's licensing books, which was a completely different beast in and of itself. So I'm doing a lot of external work. I'm going to Mattel in California to do a presentation on why we need to draw and write Barbie comics, because we can't create Barbie comics using your style guide, you know, stuff like that. So I got to be involved in a lot of stuff from 85 to 95. I would consider myself a relatively integral part of the company's operations. Not even just as a writer writing a bunch of comics for them, and most of those comics were selling really well, but that to me was secondary to what was happening internally in the office, you know?
Yeah. So like I said, you have been in the game for so long. It was funny. I was watching an
interview. Saying I'm old. You are. You're saying I'm old.
No, I'm saying long. I'm saying you have longevity in comics. That's all I'm saying.
Call me a legend. If the minute you call me a legend, that's a polite way of saying you're old.
I'm saying longevity. Nah, that's. But I did watch an interview about a year ago or something. You were on Word Balloons, I believe it was. And you were talking about kind of like wanting to go full into something. And you used two examples. You basically said, if I'm going to do something now, I want to just go all in and just go buck wild. And you use either want to go Suburban Dicks full in or Super Pro. You go to that of like full in. And those are the two things I got to just talk about before we get into the books. My viewers would rake me over the coals if I didn't at least take a 2 minutes to talk to you about Super Pro, because.
All right. Well, you have very strange viewers. Let me tell you.
I told you when I met you in Connecticut, I said, growing up for me, Super Pro got me into comics because it was a way of, in the 90s, comics weren't really cool at that time. And, you know, as a middle schooler, it's a completely different day and age now of where comics are. But I saw a sports figure, a superhero, you know, was a football player. I'm like, well, if football's cool, that means comics now have to be cool.
That was the game plan. Like I told you when we talked, that was the idea behind the whole thing. Both the NFL wanting to always find ways to gain the attention of a younger audience. They all outside of the game, they know how important licensing dollars are to 7, 8, 9, 10 year olds. And they wanted to make sure that they could find ways to access those licensing dollars that didn't necessarily require the playing of the game or the wearing of the game clothes. So they approached Marvel about the idea of doing an NFL based superhero. And I knew that was going on, but it had nothing to do with me. And it was actually Bob Budiansky, ironically enough, the editor I talked about earlier. It was his department because it was special projects, and he handled a lot of those kinds of special project development deals. And I knew that they were talking. I knew that there had been stuff going back and forth. I knew a few people had written some proposals. None of it was happening. None of it was gelling. But I was not a part of it. I was an editor by that point, I'm pretty sure. And I had my own titles to deal with, which was a pain in the ass enough as it is, because they were almost all licensed projects, which is usually twice as much work as a regular monthly book in a lot of ways. Plus I had my full slate of writing that I was doing, which at that point was like four monthly titles, I think, plus a full-time job. So I could care less about NFL Super Pro. And Bob stopped me in the hallway. I guess Bob stopping me in the hallway giveth, and Bob stopping me in the hallway taketh away. Bob stopped me in the hallway and he said, we need help with NFL Super Pro. I said, I know it's been bouncing around a while. Good luck with that. And he goes, no, we need help from you on NFL Super Pro. I go, no, we don't. I had no interest at all. He said, if you say no to me, Tom is going to ask you tomorrow. And Tom DeFalco, the editor in chief. And he goes, if you say no to Tom, Mike Hobson is going to ask you the next day. And Mike Hobson was the publisher of the company. I was like, oh, shit. So I go, what's going on? And he just basically broke it down. We've had like four different proposals submitted. They've cherry picked and liked parts of each of them, but haven't liked any of them. They're not happy with the people we've been hiring to do it, because they don't think any of them are big enough names, because they're not guys writing the mainstream successful superhero books. So they wanted me. He goes, well, they just looked at our sales and they said, we want the guys writing X-Men. And Bob didn't want to work with Scott Lobdell, who would. So he asked me to do it. So basically I had to go through everything they'd done and hone it, is what it amounts to. I created some of the villains, but I didn't create any of the supporting cast. I didn't create the origin. I didn't create the main character's backstory. I had to clean it and tighten all of it. And I did that, and they were very happy with the simplified, streamlined package. And then they asked me to write the one shot. Mm-hmm. And I was like, I don't want to write the one shot. I got a lot of work to do. And they said, you have to write the one shot. I go, okay, fine. So I wrote the one shot. And ironically enough, we hired an artist, Jose Delbo, who's a sweetheart of a man and a super artist, but knows absolutely nothing about American football, which I found to be kind of odd. Joe Jusco offered to paint the cover because he's a huge football fan, so he wanted to. I think Ron Friend and Tom had designed the look of the character together. I think Ron did most of the design work on the character. So we had a character visual that NFL had approved. And ultimately for me, it was just get this thing done and get on with it. And they dragged me back to do the monthly comic, even though I didn't want to do that either. They wanted me to commit to a year. I was like, I'm not gonna commit to a year of doing this thing. And then they said 6 months. I said four. And I said, this is it. We're done, because I've done enough. I've done my bit for King and Country. I never didn't want to do it in the first place, but I understood I had to. And I'm also, look, these guys are my friends. They're my coworkers. I've known them for years at this point. They need help. I'm going to help them. If they think I can, I'll try, you know? So I said I'd do the first four issues and that's it. And then that was okay. We agreed to that. So I did the first four issues of the monthly comic, and then that was it. I got to be honest with you. I never read a single issue after issue four. Like, I was done. It wasn't ever in my conscious sphere of attention. It became more of a thing after the fact, because at the time it was just a joke that was not a successful licensed launch. That's all. For me at the time, the two things that stood out to me is, A, I didn't get to go to the Super Bowl, but Bob Budiansky and Tom DeFalco and Mike Thompson and Tyree Stewart, the president,
you wrote me in to do this, and then you didn't give me the perks of the Super Bowl.
That was number one. But number two, what still stands out to this day is that the incentive checks on the sales of those books I wrote were really, really good, because they sold really well. So I got nice five-figure checks for the bookshelf format edition, and the combination of the first four issues of the comic probably was a nice solid five-figure check as well, for the incentives on that. So I look at it as, you know, if I'm going to whore myself out, at least I didn't whore myself out too cheaply.
That's right. Well, you're welcome for the incentive checks that I hope send you.
Yes, thank you very much for that, by the way. So I owe you a beer. There we go.
There we go. So the other side of the spectrum then is, you had mentioned going full in was your novel Suburban Dick. So I want to talk about the transition for you of where it went from, you know, working in Marvel editing and writing and doing all that stuff to now taking time out to focus in on your prose.
Well, it wasn't, honestly wasn't a transition. I had the first book idea in 1995. I had the second book idea in 1996. The actual ideas for the books never changed. A lot of the details and the development and the characters changed, but the ideas that are the foundations of each of the two books never changed. And that's because they were really extrapolated in a fictional way from things that had been happening in my real life. Mm-hmm. So I tried writing Suburban Dicks a couple times, and I never got past like issue 20 or 30. Because I didn't like what I was doing. I tried writing other prose in that time period, and I trashed it all. I deleted the files. Literally, there's probably 5 different books that I started whose files I deleted. We were just going through, my wife and I are clearing stuff out little by little in anticipation of our old age, and she found 140 pages, I think, at least, of a manuscript I'd started writing in the late 90s for kind of like a crime noir, a fictional city crime noir thing I wanted to do. And it was called New Blood, and I wrote that in the late 90s, and I hadn't looked at it. I forgot I'd even printed it out. It'd been in a box for so long. So now I got to read it, 'cause I haven't looked at it in 20 years. So I tried several times, and I wasn't happy with my output. I was hired to write a Gambit novel in the early aughts by Byron Price Books, and I was 275 pages into the manuscript, and then Marvel canceled their licensing deal with the publishing company. So my book and like 5 other books all got killed. So the 273 pages are on a little plastic 3M disc that we used to slide into the side of our laptop. I haven't looked at them in 20 something years, and I'm never going to look at them again, I don't think. But it was a Gambit novel that was present day past. So we flashed back to a lot to his childhood. Okay. But I don't know if that was any good or not, because it's been so long since I looked at it. I was just never pleased with my own prose writing. I thought it always read to me like me trying to write like someone else. And whatever author I was reading at the time that interested me, that I think that's kind of what I was absorbing and trying to emulate, because I thought that's how a prose writer should write. Now, mind you, I'm already in my 40s by that point, so my brain's not working right to think that way. You have to have a voice of your own. You have to write for yourself. And in 2017, I saw that enough comic book guys were starting to score book deals, all of varying degrees of financial success in terms of what the deal is, all in varying degrees of whether it's a hardcover or a paperback, all in varying degrees of genre. There's a crime noir here, there's a science fiction there, but a bunch of guys were doing it. And I honestly, I used my main motivations like I usually do, which is anger and jealousy. And I said, if these schmucks can do it, why can't I? I'm just as bad a writer as they are. So I broke out my Suburban Dicks idea, which I always knew was a good story with good characters. And I started typing, and it was late 2017, and I started typing, and it was never the front end of my workload, because I wasn't doing it for a paycheck. I had paying work I had to do. But through all of 2018, I typed the manuscript until I actually typed the end, which I'd never done before when I wrote a book. I'd gotten into some of them at a hefty amount of pages, right, but this is the first time I ever typed the end on a manuscript. And through the course of that typing over the course of a whole year, I was encouraged by people who read what I was doing, and that encouragement helped me because it made me realize that the words are coming together okay. I was encouraged because I was reading it and thinking that this was probably the best prose I've ever written because it was the first time I could read it and not cringe and throw it out, you know? So that was a step up. And most importantly, in the process of all of that, through other business, I secured the interest of an agent at UTA, United Talent Agency, who loved the idea and said he'd be happy to take a look at the manuscript when it was done. This was in mid-2018 that we had a business meeting on completely other stuff that Suburban Dicks was a part of that meeting just from the standpoint of presentation purposes, but he loved the idea. And I was still writing the manuscript at that point. So he said, when it's done, I'd be happy to take a look at it. That's a huge deal because selling a book without an agent is tough. Selling a book with an agent is tough. Selling one without one is almost impossible. Doesn't matter that I've been writing for 30 something years. Doesn't matter that I've sold 100 million comics. Doesn't matter that I co-created Deadpool. All of that ended up helping me in the long run. But in terms of getting an agent, that matters a little bit less because they have to want to read the book and you need to give them a reason to want to read the book. So they read it. They had a great notes on it. I did rewrites based on their notes. And by fall of 2019, we were ready to go out to publishers with it. And he got six publishers interested in it. We had six publishers make offers on it, which was phenomenal. And we ended up deciding to go with Putnam, which ironically enough is the company I worked for out of college. And because multiple publishers wanted it, you get a chance to start playing a little game. So you have a little bit of an auction, and part of the upping of the ante, it can't just be financial because you get to a point where the book will never make a profit if they pay you too much up front. Part of the deal then became a two book deal instead of a one book deal. So that's why you have two books behind you, because it was a two book deal. And Suburban Dicks came out in 2021, and it was nominated for an Edgar Award by the Mystery Writers of America as best first novel by an American author. It was nominated for a Seamus Award, which is a private investigator organization, a private investigator book organization. They nominated it under the same category, best first novel by an American author. And it was really cool. It was really, really validating. It was a lot of fun, and writing the second one was an incredibly easier task.
it makes sense that you were having fun because it is a great story idea. And I've read Suburban Dicks and Self-Made Widow, thoroughly enjoyed both, and characters you develop and things are fantastic. And you just go in depth in that. And there are people that you want to follow along with their stories. But if people haven't gotten a chance to read the series yet, what is it about?
It is about struggling to find a sense of purpose in the nightmare we call suburbia. Suburbia was intended to be a panacea and a refuge for the human race. And in my mind, having lived in suburbia for 50 something years now, and I'm 61 years old, suburbia has become an absence of life. And I say all of this without rancor. I say all of this with a complete understanding that I am fully a suburbanite. and I wanted to use the murder mystery genre as a way to explore thematic aspects of the way we live in this country. So the first book is really about fear of demographic change, about our Caucasian fear of the other moving into our neighborhood, and the influx of immigrants that has happened in my New Jersey area for the last 30 years, to a degree where, you know, the Asian population is greater than the Caucasian population in several of the towns around where I live. And I've been here the whole time. So I've been fascinatingly curious about watching it all happen. Being an immigrant myself, maybe I'd take a slightly different perspective about the whole thing. And I wanted to comment on a lot of that. The second book is really about how we endure the repetition of life and marriage in suburbia. Yeah. How we don't give ourselves enough credit for the absolute challenge that it is to have to endure the calendar cycle of the things you do routinely, garbage days, lawn debris days, recycling days, grocery shopping days, sewer payment, tax bills, all of that stuff, you know. We accept it as a part of our lives in a way I find curious from an observational standpoint. Because I don't know, I would see Anthony Bourdain eating monkey penis in Thailand, and I'd go, man, I don't want to eat monkey penis in Thailand, but damn, that's a hell of a lot better than taking the recycling out later, like I gotta do, you know. So it was a book that let me explore the difficulty that we all have, yeah. Both in living like that and also in desperately pretending that we're not living like that, you know?
Yeah. Well, it's funny, like as you're talking right there, without giving anything away, I'm literally just picturing there's like a couple page rant that one of your character does.
Yeah, that was my magnum opus.
I was just like, I'm like, oh my goodness. I'm like, man, that just hits home. And you going right there, it took me right back to that. So
the whole book, really, the Self-Made Widow, the entire book is exists only for the purpose of me having that character go on that rant. The totality of it all was me getting to shout to the world about how ridiculous scented and flavored soaps are. That's all. Because it's been an ongoing argument in my household for 20 years.
You have pillows on the bed that you can't use. There's certain towels that are just decorative towels.
Not so much that. The running joke in my own household is literally the soaps. I mean, my wife gets all these freaking soaps, and I'm like, the hell do I want coconut lime soap? Just give me effing soap. I don't have an allergy, but I think I'm very sensitive actually to heavy scents and perfumes. Okay. So there are times where she'll get a soap that I actually react to. My nasal cavity starts to react to it, and my skin gets all like tingly, you know. Not all soaps, but some of them. So it's got to be specific kinds of scents and perfumes they put in there. I only use Dove soap in the bath because that's all I can really use. I used to use other stuff, and I would actually break out in like little hives and stuff. So it is definitely a biological thing on my end of it, but it becomes an observational thing about our society that soap wasn't good enough for us. We had to start to create ludicrous soaps, and you could substitute candles the same way, you know, like how many scented candles can there be? Dude, you know, what the hell?
We got 25 in our cabinet right now.
So. Do we really need a mocha caramel candle, for God's sake? Wasn't the purpose illumination? Wasn't that the whole purpose of candles?
I think even White Castle has a candle flavor out there.
Do we really need the room to smell like something when we're lighting a candle? Anyway, I just like it was fun. It was fun to get to do. Right now, there's not going to be a third book in the series because the sales on the second book were not strong enough, and they're not happy about that, and I'm not happy with them. So it works out pretty even. And I'm working on some other stuff, but I have a book three and a book four and a book five really thought through well enough that if necessary, I could start writing tomorrow. So I'm putting it on hiatus for now. The characters are on the shelf, but they're not gone because I'm going to get back to them at some point. In some way, I'm going to get back to them and do those books. Ironically, they've still been a part of me for the last several months because I've been working on TV related aspects of the development of those characters. I just yesterday I finished doing revisions on something, and so I've been completely immersed in the first book and the characters for several months now. Even though I haven't written a third book, you know, I haven't written new prose with these characters since 2020, you know, because that's when I wrote Self-Made Widow. So I hope to get back to them, you know, in the near future. But for now, right now, I got two other things I'm percolating and developing.
Well, I do hope we get to experience those characters again, because I mean the books in themselves are self-contained, where like you can be happy with each one.
That's the that was
you
the
can
goal,
be happy
yeah.
with the way Self-Made Widow ends, but you also can be there going, I'm reading that going, oh, he's got more ideas. I was like,
it's ironic. I had the entire third book's completely broken down by chapter. It's ready to go. I mean, other than fine tuning detail as I go along, and coming up with sometimes I like to plot tightly, but then keep it loose enough that if something comes along that makes me think taking something a different tributary, a different branch, I'm able to do that as long as the branches can meet back up at the end. Otherwise, you're structurally destroying your entire work. You know, so it's tightly plotted, but not it has the bolts haven't been tightened yet. You know, I could start typing it tomorrow if a publisher was interested in doing it. You know, or if I had. If I had a means of selling it at a level that justified doing it, you know, and I'm not there yet. So for now, it's just going to sit. The file's not going anywhere. The index cards aren't going anywhere. I have them all. I could start anytime I want, you know?
Right. Well, that's good. I thoroughly enjoyed both, and I was hoping we're going to get more in that world eventually. So I will be waiting, for that. I want to be respectful of your time, Fabian. One last quick question I want to ask for you of someone who has been, you know, writing comics for so long and, you know, and writing prose now, you know, and you've been doing that for a while too. Is there a difference for you as you approach a comic, like than you do when you're approaching a prose?
You know what? I think because of the odd way that I got into prose, I was able to draw from all the benefits of anything I'd ever done in comics and not have the negatives. I think that writing comics and writing monthly comics for as long as I have really helped me with my sense of pacing and structure, helped me understand that you need to try to end every chapter with a little bit of a cliffhanger that hopefully forces the reader to go, okay, I'll just read one more chapter. Because to me, those are the best books that I read. When I'm enjoying my reading experience, I'm going to leave the light on just one more chapter, you know, that means that the writer's done something well because the reader's enjoying the experience and doesn't want it to end. And a lot of that comes down to pacing and structure and plotting and making sure that you understand the requirements of a chapter within a whole. And that comes from comic books for me because I understand the requirements of an individual issue within the whole of a monthly publishing cycle, within the whole of a shared universe of characters, you know? So that helped me quite a bit. And the other thing that helped me a lot in terms of transitioning is dialogue. I'm a little coy. John Lennon had a line in a Playboy interview many decades ago where he said he thought Paul McCartney was a little bit coy about how good a bass player he was. John Lennon thought Paul McCartney was a fabulous bass player, but Paul was always very humble about it, although Paul kind of knew he was a good bass player. You know, I feel I've always been the same way about my dialogue. I've always felt that I have a very comfortable grasp of voices and cadence and pacing in my comic book dialogue. And I've had people tell me that, people whose opinions I respect tremendously, that early on that you could close your eyes and read my book out loud and 9 times out of 10, you know what character is saying what line, you know? Mm. And to me, that's the hallmark of good dialogue, because then you know the differences between who's talking, and that's a credit to the writer that you can write dialogue in a different to create that kind of difference in cadence and voice. So I feel a little bit coy about my dialogue, and that I'm very comfortable writing dialogue in prose. I'm very comfortable writing a flow of dialogue between characters in prose. And I'd say 90% of that is due to my 25, 30 years of experience writing comic books, you know? And the other thing that probably helped me is some of my earlier writing, I tried to describe too much that didn't need to be described. And that's actually been a change in how we read anyway. Books describe stuff a lot less than they used to. They don't describe the interior of a room the way they used to. Like, you could reread The Stand. I just reread The Stand a couple of years ago, and no one, you know, I'm second in line to no one in my respect for Stephen King. But for the love of God, there's pages and pages describing a house and the rooms in the house. And the irony being, we're never going to be back in that house. This is the only time we're going to be at that house in this book. So why are you telling me all of this about this house? You know,
yeah.
I think comic books have helped me in that regard too, because an artist draws the room, you know, and I realized when I'm writing prose, I don't need to describe every single thing in the house. If you live in the suburbs, you have an understanding of what a living room is. You have an understanding of what a family room is. Right. You can throw a couple touches there, the kind of couch it is, the manufacturer to give you a sense of status. Oh, it's Ethan Allen. That's here. That's bigger than Raymore and Flanagan, you know?
Yeah.
So you can throw that kind of thing in there, but you don't have to describe every thread in the rug, you know? And I think that helped me too, because I think people prefer the reading experience right now to be a little faster paced. They don't want to sink into a quagmire of words, you know? Yeah. So all of that helped me, didn't hurt me, you know? For me, it was just feeling confident that I had a voice that I could write in, you know, and now I know that I do. And the new stuff I'm working on right now, they're very different genres. They're very different characters, but I have a voice that I'm comfortable using within that context, you know?
Yeah. Well, it makes sense because you mentioned the shorter chapters that kind of leave them on that cliffhanger. You know, I rereading Self-Made Widow, you know, where it's boom, it's like, all right, it's only a couple more pages. I can read another chapter. I can read, you know, and I'm stepping into another novel and I'm like, they're 30 page chapters. I'm going, oh, all right, let me just finish this chapter and I'll be done no matter what happens.
Yeah, there's a fine line. It's really difficult to gauge. I mean, look, James Patterson writes 4 or 5 page chapters, which comes across as a little ludicrous sometimes, you know, but he's also hit on a formula that is ridiculously successful because there's a huge amount of readers that are quite comfortable with that pace. My chapters were anywhere from 8 to 12 pages long, each of them.
Yep.
And that was a conscious decision on my part that was craft and experience had made it easier for me to do that in the second book than the first. The first book, I had to cut a lot of pages because I overwrote a lot. Second book was almost like, okay, now I know what I'm doing. Now I'm an old pro. By the way, I was nominated for an award. Piece of cake. So the second book was easier in all regards for me as a writer than the first book was. And as a result, I had more control and command of the structure. And I think I nailed that 8 to 12 pages per chapter pretty consistently throughout the whole thing. They're not so short that it's almost comical, but they're not so long that you go, okay, that's enough for tonight, you know? Right.
Yeah, no, I think it's brilliant. So, well, Fabian, I could talk to you for hours and I want to respect your time. So thank you so much for taking some time.
My pleasure. To talk about, to come back anytime.
Yeah. Real quick, where can people follow along with you? So with the new stuff you got working on and just keep up to date with you.
You can always DM me because my DMs are open as long as you're not an ass on Twitter at Fabian Nicieza. You can always reach me via email through my author website, which is at FabianNicieza.com. There's a contact tab. You can always email me through that. I am pretty open and accessible on social media, as anyone who has dealt with me knows. And I'm very quick to block if you're an ass, and I'm very quick to engage if you're not. So my recommendation for you, for the most part, would be don't be an ass for you people out there listening. So I look forward to hearing from everybody, and I thank you very, very much, Greg. It was a really fun interview. A good time.
Absolutely. With that being said, gang, hopefully you can find some time to curl up, grab a book, and nerd out.
Sounds good to me.